Escuelas oficiales de idiomas de la región de Murcia. Pruebas específicas de certificación. Comprensión de textos orales. Nivel B2. Convocatoria, junio 2019.
School when I was about 5 was amazing because I was absolutely top of every class, well, top of my class, and I was reading in front of people and I thought of myself as being unbelievably intelligent. And then when I was 6, they realised that I hadn't been reading at all and that my mum read to me all the time. We had lots of books at home and I'd memorised them. And it was only when somebody finally gave me a book that my mum hadn't read me that they realised that I hadn't been reading at all and couldn't read at all. So when I was 6, I went from being the top of the class to the absolute bottom of the class. And I still remember what a shock that was. And I still remember how I saw myself completely differently from that moment. I was really, really lucky. I was at a brilliant state primary school. And also my brother had been there before and he'd been diagnosed with dyslexia, so they'd already dealt with him. And the teachers there said to my parents, you need to find a carrot to dangle in front of Kira. There's no reason that she shouldn't be able to read and there's no reason that she shouldn't be able to, you know, do well at school, but you need to find a carrot. And really fortunately for me, I wanted to act. So it was my head teacher, who was a brilliant man called David Cooper, who said to my mum, if she wants to act, then you let her act, but she's only allowed to do it if her grades either stay the same or go up. If she drops a grade, then you take the carrot away. I think I've always been very creative. You know, I was always, it was art, it was drama, it was music. I was always very good at creative writing. I was top of those classes. It's just that my spelling was awful. Again, the teachers that I had recognised how important it was that I knew that the points that I was making and the pieces of creative writing, the stories that I were telling, were great and were valid and were interesting, and that they gave me a mark for that. And that the spelling and the punctuation was entirely different. Because when you split them up, you're not saying you're not intelligent enough. What you're saying is, hey, you're not very good at this bit, and that's fine. That's fine. Deal with that bit, but well done, because that was a great story. Because actually, you know, confidence is the most important thing, and if you tell a child that they're not good at something, and you tell a child that they're stupid, then they'll feel like they are. And so I think it's really important to say you're not stupid. Your brain simply works differently than other people, and you can find different ways around it, and you'll be good at other things. You may not be a brilliant speller, you may not be a very fast reader, but you will learn how to read, and you will learn as much spelling as you need to, you know, but you'll be better at different things. And I think that's unbelievably important to know as a kid. My spelling makes people laugh. It makes me laugh, actually. And my reading, if I'm sight reading, oh, it's a complete joke. I mean, it'll mean something else completely. It won't make any sense at all. Which, you know, for what I do for a living, was quite difficult, because if you give me a page of dialogue now, I can just about do it. But I mean, it jumps about and, you know, it takes me a while. I really need to learn it. I need to sit with it. I always have to say, you cannot give me a rewritten scene on the day and think that I'm going to be able to perform it well. If you give me a rewritten scene the day before and I have a night to work on it, I will be able to do it well. School when I was about five was amazing because I was absolutely top of every class. Well, top of my class. And I was reading in front of people and I thought of myself as being unbelievably intelligent. And then when I was six, they realised that I hadn't been reading at all and that my mum read to me all the time. We had lots of books at home and I'd memorised them. And it was only when somebody finally gave me a book that my mum hadn't read me that they realised that I hadn't been reading at all and couldn't read at all. So when I was six, I went from being the top of the class to the absolute bottom of the class. And I still remember what a shock that was. And I still remember how I saw myself completely differently from that moment. I was really, really lucky. I was at a brilliant state primary school. And also my brother had been there before and he'd been diagnosed with dyslexia. So they'd already dealt with him. And the teachers there said to my parents, you need to find a carrot to dangle in front of Kira. There's no reason that she shouldn't be able to read and there's no reason that she shouldn't be able to, you know, do well at school, but you need to find a carrot. And really fortunately for me, I wanted to act. So it was my head teacher, who was a brilliant man called David Cooper, who said to my mum, if she wants to act, then you let her act, but she's only allowed to do it if her grades either stay the same or go up. If she drops a grade, then you take the carrot away. I think I've always been very creative. You know, I was always, it was art, it was drama, it was music. I was always very good at creative writing. I was top of those classes. It's just that my spelling was awful. Again, the teachers that I had recognised how important it was that I knew that the points that I was making and the pieces of creative writing, the stories that I were telling, were great and were valid and were interesting, and that they gave me a mark for that. And that the spelling and the punctuation was entirely different. Because when you split them up, you're not saying you're not intelligent enough. What you're saying is, hey, you're not very good at this bit, and that's fine. That's fine. Deal with that bit, but well done, because that was a great story. Because actually, you know, confidence is the most important thing. And if you tell a child that they're not good at something, and you tell a child that they're stupid, then they'll feel like they are. And so I think it's really important to say you're not stupid. Your brain simply works differently than other people and you can find different ways around it and you'll be good at other things. You may not be a brilliant speller, you may not be a very fast reader, but you will learn how to read and you will learn as much spelling as you need to, you know, but you'll be better at different things. And I think that's unbelievably important to know as a kid. My spelling makes people laugh. It makes me laugh, actually. And my reading, if I'm sight reading, oh, it's a complete joke. I mean, it'll mean something else completely. It won't make any sense at all. Which, you know, for what I do for a living, was quite difficult, because if you give me a page of dialogue now, I can just about do it. But I mean, it jumps about and, you know, it takes me a while. I really need to learn it. I need to sit with it. I always have to say, you cannot give me a rewritten scene on the day and think that I'm going to be able to perform it well. If you give me a rewritten scene the day before and I have a night to work on it, I will be able to do it well.
Having enough protein in your diet to meet your basic needs is not necessarily the same as having the right amount for optimum health. When I asked David Katz how much protein a person should consume, he said certain people may indeed require more than the minimum recommendation of 0.8 grams per kilo of body weight, including athletes like my son. The problem is that once we start thinking more protein is automatically better, it can be hard to know when to stop. The idea that protein is synonymous with healthy eating leads many people to eat in disordered ways that are far from healthy, either for body or mind. A couple of years ago, Sarah Shepherd, a 30-something British sports journalist, realised she was obsessed with protein. On a typical day, she was eating 3 or 4 protein bars, hard-boiled eggs, meat, fish and non-starchy vegetables, and a couple of protein shakes. Virtually the only carbs in her diet came from the protein bars and shakes. It reached the point where she had so little energy in the evenings because of the lack of calories in her body that she stopped going out. Shepherd's protein obsession started when injury forced her to give up running. After she started doing boxing and circuits with a new trainer, he told her she should be eating more protein to help prevent future injuries. To start with, Shepherd's new low-carb, high-protein regime felt wonderful. She lost weight, gained muscle, and became one of the many people at the gym clutching their sleek flask of protein shake like an amulet. However, she noticed her thoughts about protein were becoming obsessive. Given the choice between an apple and a protein bar, she always chose the protein bar, even though at a rational level she knew that a piece of fresh fruit with its fibre and vitamins had a lot to recommend it over a processed snack. By the time she finally sought help from a sports nutritionist, he said he had never seen anyone with such an intense fitness regime who ate so little carbohydrate. She was consuming 150 grams of protein a day, around 2.5 grams per kilo of body weight, far in excess of the upper limit recommended for bodybuilders by the US Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. Shepherd slowly weaned herself back onto a more balanced diet that included a range of complex carbohydrates such as oats and brown rice. Despite her apprehension, she did not gain weight. When I spoke to her, Shepherd had been eating a balanced diet for more than 2 years without any ill effects and was a bit mystified as to how she had drifted into her protein fixation. Encouraged by the marketers of high-protein foods, many people talk about whether we have reached our daily target for macros, but we do not talk so much about how much is too much. Adding extra protein beyond our needs can be harmful for people with underlying kidney or liver problems, as the body can struggle to process the excess. Having enough protein in your diet to meet your basic needs is not necessarily the same as having the right amount for optimum health. When I asked David Katz how much protein a person should consume, he said certain people may indeed require more than the minimum recommendation of 0.8 grams per kilo of body weight, including athletes like my son. The problem is that once we start thinking more protein is automatically better, it can be hard to know when to stop. The idea that protein is synonymous with healthy eating leads many people to eat in disordered ways that are far from healthy, either for body or mind. A couple of years ago, Sarah Shepherd, a 30-something British sports journalist, realised she was obsessed with protein. On a typical day, she was eating 3 or 4 protein bars, hard-boiled eggs, meat, fish and non-starchy vegetables, and a couple of protein shakes. Virtually the only carbs in her diet came from the protein bars and shakes. It reached the point where she had so little energy in the evenings because of the lack of calories in her body that she stopped going out. Shepherd's protein obsession started when injury forced her to give up running. After she started doing boxing and circuits with a new trainer, he told her she should be eating more protein to help prevent future injuries. To start with, Shepherd's new low-carb, high-protein regime felt wonderful. She lost weight, gained muscle, and became one of the many people at the gym clutching their sleek flask of protein shake like an amulet. However, she noticed her thoughts about protein were becoming obsessive. Given the choice between an apple and a protein bar, she always chose the protein bar, even though at a rational level, she knew that a piece of fresh fruit with its fibre and vitamins had a lot to recommend it over a processed snack. By the time she finally sought help from a sports nutritionist, he said he had never seen anyone with such an intense fitness regime who ate so little carbohydrate. She was consuming 150 grams of protein a day, around 2.5 grams per kilo of body weight, far in excess of the upper limit recommended for bodybuilders by the US Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. Shepherd slowly weaned herself back onto a more balanced diet that included a range of complex carbohydrates such as oats and brown rice. Despite her apprehension, she did not gain weight. When I spoke to her, Shepherd had been eating a balanced diet for more than 2 years without any ill effects and was a bit mystified as to how she had drifted into her protein fixation. Encouraged by the marketers of high-protein foods, many people talk about whether we have reached our daily target for macros, but we do not talk so much about how much is too much. Adding extra protein beyond our needs can be harmful for people with underlying kidney or liver problems, as the body can struggle to process the excess.
I'd like to take you back about 7 years in my life. Friday afternoon, a few days before Christmas, 2009, I was the director of operations at a consumer products company in San Francisco, and I was called into a meeting that was already in progress. That meeting turned out to be my exit interview. I was fired, along with several others. I was 64 years old at the time. It wasn't completely unexpected. I signed a stack of papers, gathered my personal effects, and left to join my wife, who was waiting for me at a nearby restaurant, completely unaware. Fast forward several hours, we both got really silly drunk. 40-plus years of continuous employment for a variety of companies, large and small, was over. I had a good network, a good reputation. I thought I'd be just fine. I was an engineer in manufacturing and packaging. I had a good background. Retirement was, like for so many people, simply not an option for me. So I turned to consulting for the next couple of years without any passion whatsoever. And then an idea began to take root, born from my concern for our environment. I wanted to build my own business, designing and manufacturing biodegradable packaging from waste, paper, agricultural, even textile waste, replacing the toxic disposable plastic packaging to which we've all become addicted. This is called clean technology, and it felt really meaningful to me. A venture that could help to reduce the billions of pounds of single-use plastic packaging dumped each year and polluting our land, our rivers, and our oceans, and left for future generations to resolve. Our grandchildren, my grandchildren. And so now, at the age of 66, with 40 years of experience, I became an entrepreneur for the very first time. Lots of issues to deal with. Manufacturing, outsourcing, job creation, patents, partnerships, funding. These are all typical issues for a startup, but hardly typical for me. And a word about funding. I live and work in San Francisco, and if you're looking for funding, you are typically going to compete with some very young people from the high-tech industry. And it can be very discouraging and intimidating. But 5 years later, I'm thrilled and proud to share with you that our revenues have doubled every year. We have no debt. We have several marquee clients. Our patent was issued. I have a wonderful partner who's been with me right from the beginning. And we've won more than 20 awards for the work that we've done. But best of all, we've made a small dent, a very small dent, in the worldwide plastic pollution crisis. And I am doing the most rewarding and meaningful work of my life right now. And I can tell you, there's lots of resources available. I'd like to take you back about 7 years in my life. Friday afternoon, a few days before Christmas, 2009, I was the director of operations at a consumer products company in San Francisco, and I was called into a meeting that was already in progress. That meeting turned out to be my exit interview. I was fired, along with several others. I was 64 years old at the time. It wasn't completely unexpected. I signed a stack of papers, gathered my personal effects, and left to join my wife, who was waiting for me at a nearby restaurant, completely unaware. Fast forward several hours, we both got really silly drunk. 40-plus years of continuous employment for a variety of companies, large and small, was over. I had a good network, a good reputation. I thought I'd be just fine. I was an engineer in manufacturing and packaging. I had a good background. Retirement was, like for so many people, simply not an option for me. So I turned to consulting for the next couple of years without any passion whatsoever. And then an idea began to take root, born from my concern for our environment. I wanted to build my own business, designing and manufacturing biodegradable packaging from waste, paper, agricultural, even textile waste, replacing the toxic disposable plastic packaging to which we've all become addicted. This is called clean technology, and it felt really meaningful to me. A venture that could help to reduce the billions of pounds of single-use plastic packaging dumped each year and polluting our land, our rivers, and our oceans, and left for future generations to resolve. Our grandchildren, my grandchildren. And so now, at the age of 66, with 40 years of experience, I became an entrepreneur for the very first time. Lots of issues to deal with. Manufacturing, outsourcing, job creation, patents, partnerships, funding. These are all typical issues for a startup, but hardly typical for me. And a word about funding. I live and work in San Francisco, and if you're looking for funding, you are typically going to compete with some very young people from the high-tech industry. And it can be very discouraging and intimidating. But 5 years later, I'm thrilled and proud to share with you that our revenues have doubled every year. We have no debt. We have several marquee clients. Our patent was issued. I have a wonderful partner who's been with me right from the beginning. And we've won more than 20 awards for the work that we've done. But best of all, we've made a small dent, a very small dent, in the worldwide plastic pollution crisis. And I am doing the most rewarding and meaningful work of my life right now. And I can tell you, there's lots of resources available.
Fin de la prueba.